Welcome to the Anarchist Book Club with Danny Evans and me, Jim Yeoman. This episode is something of a special, a recording of our first ever live event, which was held on Friday, 8th of October, 2021 on Zoom. We were delighted to be joined by Mike Finn and Dana Mills to mark the recent publication of Mike's book, Debating Anarchism, with Bloomsbury. Mike's book is a brilliant, provocative introduction to the debates which surround anarchist history and theory, so we felt this would be a good opportunity to explore some of these with Mike himself and Dana, an activist and scholar of, amongst many other works, a brilliant biography of Rosa Luxemburg, published in 2020 with Reaction Books. Towards the end of our conversation, we opened up for some audience questions, which is another first for us. We hope you enjoy the episode.
So good evening, everybody. Thanks very much for attending. You're very welcome. My name's Danny. I'm one half of the Anarchist Book Club with Danny and Jim, and we're delighted and honoured to be hosting this evening's conversation with Mike Finn to celebrate the release of his new book, Debating Anarchism. And we're equally delighted to be joined by Dana Mills, author of a recent biography of Rosa Luxemburg, who's also going to be responding to the questions that we've prepared for Mike. So hopefully it's going to be a conversation that lets you in on some of the themes and ideas that are going on in Mike's book, but which also lend themselves to a broader conversation, potentially of interest to anyone who is interested in socialist history. There is a question function, a Q&A function that you should be able to see at the bottom of the screen. So if anyone has questions that they'd like to ask of Mike or Dana or the panel, then please just click on that and type the questions in. If there's any like problems with that, the functionality of that, then please just let us know in the chat. We will try and address as many of those questions as possible after this initial conversation is over. Jim, if you want to take over with the first question for Mike.
Hello, everyone. As some of you may have caught at the start there, this is quite a new experience for me doing this kind of thing, but I know you're there, your presence is there, and it's really nice to do this because this will be our first time doing something kind of live, so that's nice, isn't it? And also, yeah, great to be here with Mike and Dana. It's a real treat on this Friday evening. So, Mike, we're going to kind of open with a question to you, but obviously, Dana, this is going to kind of bring in, you know, your own thoughts as well. One of the things we've talked about on our podcast quite a lot is thinking about anarchism in a way that makes it a live question, something that's worth considering. And I felt, and we both really felt, that the title of the book, The Debate in Anarchism, and the part of this series of debates in world history, and the way that you frame the book, Mike, it's very much kind of framed in this way of here are many different kind of takes on these particular major themes in anarchism. Is that a way you think of thinking about anarchism in this way as part of this live ongoing conversation, instead of perhaps what we find quite commonly thinking about anarchism as a kind of an historical event or phenomenon to be cherished, almost like a relic, where it's kind of preserved, but therefore actually there isn't anything to debate anymore, that the history's already been written. So yeah, I'll pass that over to Mike first, and then Dana, if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, so I think the debating framing and the way the series works, you know, debates in world history, I think that definitely was a positive for me to start with, because as you say, it brought it to the now, or from the now. And I think partly there's two elements to that. I think first thing is that the field, those of us that work in anarchist studies, which obviously is several of us here, you know, the field itself has developed massively in the last 20 years. And partly that corresponds to, has parallels with things that are going on in the political space. And partly it's separate from that. So the now is important, like on an academic level, as well as on a political level. But actually just on a personal level, I was not a historian of anarchism. You know, the people on this call, including yourselves, you know, much more longer in the tooth historians of anarchism than me, and know more than I do, undoubtedly. You know, I think what happened with me was I was a historian of modern Britain, who became an historian of anarchism because I was interested in anarchism on a political and a social level, on activist level. And so in some ways, the debating side of it was actually very useful for me because I was personally coming from the now. I was personally coming from movement spaces. And so for me, it was a kind of, this is where you start sounding like Gwyneth Paltrow on the Oscars, you know, and you start saying it was a journey. It was a journey. But, you know, there was a question of, I was reading my way into anarchism over a sort of 6-7 year period, having been involved in some activism. And then, you know, this was kind of the culmination of that. So in a sense, it, like on a personal level, it was always going to be rooted in the now, because inevitably that's where I was starting from. I said, but on the other hand, I think the academic side of it, it reflects the fact that, you know, anarchism is getting taken more seriously in academic circles now. You know, many of us who work on anarchism sometimes play a little bit of a violin and say, you know, we're never going to get jobs in some institutions because we work on this stuff, because we do X, Y, and Z. But the reality is, you know, there has been something, to quote a kind of controversial title of an anarchist term within the academy. And that there has been something of an anarchist term within the academy, and that has happened. And, you know, so there are live debates. But the final point I just make to close my witter is the series itself is envisaged by the publisher as an introduction into topics that are live for primarily for undergraduates, I think. So the aim when I did the book was, well, I knew I would have to structure in that way anyway. So it all kind of came together quite nicely, I think.
I think Mike is being very humble, but a lot of the reason that the book is very alive and of the now is because the way that you structured it and the way that you wrote it and the way that you brought information that could be dry at the pen of someone else. But I think there's something very subtle and engaging and very deep in the way that Mike brings forward theoretical basis and the history, which is to understand how certain. So I'm going to quote, sorry, this is like 12 minutes into the Zoom and I'm already quoting socialists. So this is going to be my shtick here. I'm going to quote people and go, no. History repeats itself. First is tragedy, second is farce. Third is ideological turn of any movement that you choose, right? So when you read these kind of accounts of movements that we think that we understand that happened in the past, and then you look at the news and you go, yeah, but there are a lot of things that are happening right now that you can really understand deeply if you actually looked at continuity and, of course, change of ideas. And I think there's a way in which Mike writes historiography that really illuminates that and gives the reader the ability to engage in that way, which is really, really important. And the other thing I'll say in this context, which I really like, is the kind of thinking about how people misunderstand anarchism and use it as a pejorative. So, you know, that's probably for many people, that's the first acquaintance you have with the concept when you're called an anarchist, right? And then there's a moment in which you think, maybe that's not a bad thing. You know, I was told that as an insult, and then maybe you start owning it, right? But I think there's something about the discursive and really kind of linguistic building of that historiography, which is really very important. And yes, there's been an anarchist turn in the academy, but equally there's been so much, I mean, I don't have to go on into it in the Zoom. I am a refugee of their neoliberal academy, but it is kind of this huge swathe of neoliberalism. So perhaps it's not surprising that there's an anarchist turn, because this kind of crushing of liberty and crushing of any kind of ideational emancipation, you know, dialectics is a thing. It kind of yields, sorry, again, I'm going all socialist with you and on the Zoom, but you can really see what's happening there. And, you know, if you look at recent phenomena that we can relate to anarchism, be it Extinction Rebellion or even Occupy, not so long ago, we had the anniversary of that. You know, this is something that, again, it's a direct response to how people are sort of shoved into boxes and not allowed any kind of thinking space at all. So I think it's a really important, not only historiographical and academic intervention, but a political one, that we need to think about our lives now in a broader context and to understand how and why movements are coming into being and why they're so significant right now and why we must listen to them better and not just think about how people are poo-pooing them from positions of power.
You know, your background is primarily on kind of more socialist movement. Have you read many kind of, as Mike said, introductory accounts to anarchism? Are you familiar with some of the classic takes, and does Mike stand out for you in that way?
Yes, I am. So I can tell you a little bit about how I got to, actually, I think it's also how I got to know Mike, which is kind of a nice story. But I am indeed, so like Mike said, he's not in the history of anarchism. I'm not a historian of socialism either. I am a left-wing Jewish Israeli activist who's been really interested in dissenting with Jewish women on the left for a very long time. There's a book I've been writing for a while, maybe one day I'll finish it. I'm now right now working in politics, so maybe I won't, depending on how things go. But that book aimed to look at women critiquing nationalism. And one of the key protagonists of this book is clearly one Emma Goldman. I kind of, on this Zoom, I don't have to say it, but I'll say it. So I kind of went the other way because I started with Emma being a clear kind of interesting woman and someone who always appealed to me. And then I started reading about anarchism to understand her better. And then one thing that's, and then I looked at her contemporaries and read about that all that period. I also work on Eleanor Marx, and then her relationship with anarchists is in itself really interesting. So one thing I realized very quickly is that there's a huge discrepancy between the way that anarchists write about themselves and the way that anarchists are described from the outside. So all the kind of guides to tend to be like someone who is not anarchist saying, there is this movement, I will now explain it to you, this is how it works. And first of all, it's really dull when you read, you know, either biographical accounts or letters or whatever, and you just feel the fire. And then you read these kind of accounts, you just think you have no idea which kind of people you're writing about. But yeah, the ideas are often pursued inaccurately, and there are a lot of labels and stigmas, including from the socialist side, I should say. I kind of feel like I'm not like that. That's my representation here, of just misunderstanding what anarchism stood for. And I think that's where Mike's book is really very unique, because he gives you both the arc of history and the precision of the theory. It's not either or, you don't have to choose, really. I'm sure there are a lot of great books I've not read, but from the anarchist books I have read, Mike's is certainly the best. The other thing that I'll say in this context is the kind of, and I'm going back again to the way that Mike introduced himself, and saying, you know, we are very much pigeonholed these days in academic writing in a way that we have been trained to a specific field and then we have to write about, we want more publications, et cetera. But when you write from the heart and when it's something that you engage in your life outside of the classroom, it just comes across in the book. You know, it's something that is really, very important. And I think there's something very revolutionary and really important. I think galvanizing for the reader and for other writers who might pick up the book and say, I have a passion for another movement that I feel is deeply misunderstood, I'll take it on. Rather than, and again, being assigned topics or being a historian of X and then doing it for like 20 years because you're a historian of X. So I think that's a really important intervention in its own right. And a brave one, I should say, especially in this climate.
Dane has already introduced the antagonism between anarchism and certain other branches of socialism, particularly Marxist socialism. Is possible, particularly going back to like the so-called founding fathers, to write a kind of introductory history of anarchism that is essentially sort of by definition antagonistic to Marxism? So Mike, I wondered what you thought about that approach and whether you think by contrast there's any possibility of writing a history in which overlaps between anarchism and Marxism are made more apparent, if indeed you think that there are such overlaps.
I mean, I absolutely think there's such overlaps. And I think where we've been for a long time on the left, you know, those of us who are interested in the history of anarchism and interested in the history of socialism, Marxism more generally, is, you know, we're creatures of mythology to some degree. We've been subjected to the kind of sectarian debates that we've inherited, you know, and the, you know, a lot of that is, I mean, you certainly, I mean, just speak from the anarchist side for a minute, you know, a lot of that has become almost like holy writ, you know, in terms of, you know, Proudhon said this, Marx said that, there was the international, there was this split, and look, the 20th century is vindication of what Bakunin said, basically, you know, then there's that narrative that exists, you know, and there's that figure on the left. I know that you both, Jim and Danny, have talked about this actually quite a lot on the podcast. I think it's really interesting the way you reflect on it. You know, there is that figure of the pious anarchist, you know, who kind of sits there and like is right about every 15 times domination wins out over freedom in the last 10 times that it happened, you know. So you know, there is that from the anarchist side. But then from the Marxist side, you've also had a situation where, and obviously I'm talking about one specific ambit of Marxism, which is Marxism-Leninism in the context of the Soviet Union, where you've had a fairly major political force that has sought to introduce anarchism at every point because that was in its political interest so to do. So there's a reason why things are the way they are that we all understand. But I think that, you know, I think the task, I mean, before we get into the activism, as historians, our task is to go beyond that, right, and try and historicize it and try and get into it and unpack what it means. And I think one of the reasons that Dana's kind of alluded to, you know, the fact how we know each other and how we came to know each other, that kind of tells it in its own way, is that when you try and historicize these things and you're trying to understand, if you like, the socialist moment rather than the anarchist or Marxist moment of the second half of the 19th century, there's so much more pluralism. You know, the scholars that I stand on the shoulders of in this book have shown us how much more pluralism there is, how people were one minute anarchists and then the next minute Marxists, and drawing on both. And I try in the book to use vignettes, because I used to be a journalist, so I use vignettes. So I try to use vignettes and little stories to illustrate some of that. And one of the chapters starts off with the trial of Auguste Vaillant, who was the propagandist of the Deed, who bombed the French Chamber of Deputies in 1893, I think it was. Constance is on, so Constance will correct me if I'm wrong. But in that trial, one of the things that was really interesting is the extent to which, you know, Vaillant explicitly references in his courtroom speech Marx. He explicitly references Herbert Spencer. You know, he's referencing all kinds of people, and it's much more, you know, it intersects a lot more. The socialist left is not as defined in the ways that it becomes, you know, after the Second International, after the things that happen later on. And just on the big ticket stuff, you know, because people often quite rightly criticize the canon, you know, the anarchist canon. Matt Adams, Ruth have done a lot of that, and rightly so. But like, one of the things you can find if you look at it in a more nuanced way is, you know, Bakunin himself isn't actually that shy about how much he takes from Marx. You know, he's you know, there's a fair degree of openness at that point about how much he is derivative of Marx. And, you know, one of the things that really, so in answer to your question, Danny, in sum, yeah, I think it's absolutely possible to write a history that is much less sectarian and collapses those boundaries. But also, like, you know, the extent to which, you know, what have been seen as poles apart, anarchism and Marxism, are really not poles apart in many ways. You know, the story of the International tells you that actually in itself, in a way, because, yeah, it splits. And, yeah, you know, the anarchism develops as a political or social movement out of the International in many ways. But they were in the International together for a reason to start with, you know, and they have an awful lot in common. And that's why, like, you know, when I talk about anarchism, I tend to talk anarchism as a form of socialism, and I see Marxism as that part of that family. And it's a family which has disagreements, and some of those are very hostile. And obviously we know that a lot of people end up dead because some of those disagreements. So it's not to be trivialized. But I think it is possible to write history of the correspondences, the interactions, the intersections. And I think the division is more due to subsequent political developments than it is to historical authenticity, I'd say, but at risk of imperiling myself. But yeah.
If I may take from the other side of socialism and anarchism, from, you know, the obvious counter position, I completely agree with you, Mike. And I think, I mean, the Second International is like one of the most curious and important periods. And I think misunderstood in many ways. A lot of people think they understand exactly what happened there. And I have to say, after I spent like seven years of my life with it, I still don't fully understand the entire arc of events there. But I think socialism itself is so convoluted, and there's so many different divisions that happen in this period and inner conflicts, and I would say so many ideological divides that some, you know, some representatives of so-called the same streams who come to the same cause can hardly be seen as sort of coming from the same place. So it's very easy within that framework to see anarchism as someone who takes it a little bit further. But I think, you know, it's very interesting. We started by talking about the here and now and thinking about how divisions or political power struggles, personality struggles, then lead to ideological divides. And, you know, these are not things that are always clear cut. It's not always easy to say, you know, this is an ideological cleavage that we cannot overcome. Cannot work together, etc., rather than two people who absolutely can't work with each other, and different constellations of personalities and different kind of political prisms. And I think, you know, the Second International was definitely that. There were a lot of very big personalities. There were a lot of remarkable people who worked at the same time, and the world was kind of too small to house all of them within one room. But I mean, I'm going to do something very banal. I hope you forgive me and humor me. I haven't done anything academic for a while, so this is pure indulgence for me, and go back to the Rosa Luxemburg-Lenin debate. every single Leninist Marxist that I know says, no, you misunderstand her, but she's not that obsessed with freedom. And as her biographer, I can tell you, she really is. She really is interested in freedom in a very deep, theoretical, philosophical way. You can see it in her letters. You can see it in other places in her writing. And the reason why I go to this anecdotal moment is to sort of say, you know, within the big world, Rosa and Lenin are seen as like, yes, they go different ways in the same moment, but you can read them together. You know, she had her own quarrels with anarchists, but, you know, in some places she really is seeking a lot of the things that anarchists of her time are writing about. And if she had, I think, better knowledge of, especially, I would say, her American contemporaries, which she didn't read at all. She didn't know American theory at all. She understood a little bit about, you know, the kind of what's happening in terms of colonialism, imperialism, et cetera, in America, but she didn't read theory from that part of the world. She was very parochial European. I think she might have found new places to find herself. And I think, again, this is kind of her representative on Earth for a while, that there is a place to talk about how, at this point, freedom loses its place within Marxist theory and just becomes something completely different and maybe gets appropriated by another stream of thinking. And how terrible that is, really, because we all know, I kind of feel like I always have this argument with Leninists. In the end, she was right, he was wrong. You know, we know that the Russian Revolution was a monumentous event, but when she said, if you don't stand up for freedom, everything goes, we know that in the end, she read history correctly. This is, I know, a very far-reaching reading, but I do think that I'll try and sum up because there was a lot going on, I know, but we need to sort of look beyond how things are given to us and kind of these divisions that are, this is a socialist, this is an anarchist, they hated each other, so hence they don't belong together, and try to think anew how we can find inner fertilization and kind of inner conversations between those people.
Diana, that's really interesting. I'd just like to come back on it, if I may. If we think about Rosa Luxemburg in this light, then how do we contextualize her more vituperative like writings about anarchists? Because is it possible that, you know, she's protesting too much in a way, right? So if you like, you have the beginning of, you know, the mass strike. So it seems like she thinks what I'm going to say in this pamphlet is going to bring accusations of anarchism on me, so I need to like be even more like hostile to anarchists than Marxists normally are in order to like stave off those criticisms.
Completely agree. And I mean, in everything that she writes, she first starts with an offense that says, these are the people you shouldn't associate with me with, and this is how you should read me, which is a rather vain and interesting way to write. I don't think I've read many people who are like, this is how you misunderstand me, and now I will give you the right reading. Again, I think that's absolutely spot on. Thank you for that, Dan. It's really kind of helpful to go back to that moment because it's exactly what she's doing. She's positioning herself against a political stream. She's not actually taking on the ideas. When you read the pamphlet, there's a lot of the ideas in there, but she's just like, don't read me together with them. And I think when you look at the mass strike in her reading and how she thinks that strikes, well, obviously that's an idea that is kind of a red thread in her writing throughout the revolutionary pamphlets, throughout her entire life. It's exactly a practice in freedom. It's exactly, you come together to strike, and that's how you learn to be free from capitalism. So, you know, there is something there in terms of her reading, and she basically tries to position and reposition herself and put herself within the ideological framework of the time. But the ideas themselves have different traction and I think have different weight. And I don't know, I think, you know, there is a book to be written. I don't know, Mike, if you have another project in mind. If not, I can give you your next book idea that I want to read, which is how socialists have taken ideas and completely appropriate them or taken them to their own strands while putting down anarchists. You know, that's the irony of the whole debate. But certainly intellectually, you can see crossovers and you can see cross-fertilization in that way.
If I'm just coming on that one, I don't want to sign up to any more book projects. And, you know, I could throw that one straight back at you, Dana, because you could do that. Well, maybe we could divvy it up, but if you'd be up for it. But, you know, I think one of the just historical moments sprang to mind when you were talking about that. And one of the things that the moment that sprung to mind was actually a little bit after Rosa's time, which is the late 50s into the 60s. And the reason that sprang to mind was because obviously the rise of the new left and situationism and all the stuff that happens in the course of the 60s and libertarian forms of Marxism that, you know, emerged, developed alongside the student movement and so on. And then what happens in the May 68 events as well, in terms of, you know, Danny Cohn-Bendit, who is he, you know, what's going on there? And, you know, is anarchism back? Is anarchism a thing in this space? You know, where's the divide between that and Marxism in this space and all the rest of it? And the interesting thing about that period is you do see, almost at times, I think you do see some of the student leaders working really hard to maintain the divides, and you see others working really hard to just collapse the divides completely. And so this issue about what you're talking about going back to Rosa's writings, the extent to which what she says parallels some anarchist ideas and would have, you know, worked very well with them. You see the same pattern happen again in the 50s and 60s, but actually there's a determination by some in the student movement to bridge that gap, and there's a determination by others not to. And there's the famous quote from Cohn-Bendit where he goes, "I'm a Marxist in the way that Bakunin was," which is you know, a quote the students love throwing back at me, from my Marxist students love throwing back at me. But, you know, is I think actually really quite a pointed quote about the self-awareness of some of the 68 generation in terms of, yeah, we are anarchists and yeah, we are Marxists. And, you know, people might look at that and heads explode, but nonetheless, those correspondences are real. And, you know, people before us have seen those correspondences. And I like the phrase that you said, it's not just about what's handed down to us. You know, we have the opportunity to bridge these gaps. So, you know, I think it's really kind of on us to do that, I think.
Yeah, that's great. I was trying to think if the reverse would work as well, if you could be a Bakuninist in the way Marx was. I wonder if that sounds like a snappy kind of retort. I don't know, to be honest. I haven't given it any thought, so I'm not gonna pin my colours to that mast. We've kind of moved into almost, you know, as if we, you know, we'd planned it. You know, we've moved quite naturally into the kind of next thing we wanted to talk about, because both Mike and Dana, you know, you have worked on kind of individual studies. Mike, I know that you run a course on Emma Goldman, and Dana, obviously, you know, the biographer of Rosa Luxemburg. So you have this interest in individuals as kind of windows out into kind of broader things. And it is a trend that we find quite a lot in histories of anarchism, which focus on key individuals. And I just, you know, wanted to throw out, you know, what do you think are the benefits of doing that, and also any potential drawbacks? Because it's something that I grapple with quite a lot, about whether I want to, you know, whether I want to go down the road of a kind of individual focus, and then, yeah, never quite sure. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts in either order. Dana, do you want to start this one?
Yeah, thanks, because she came first in history, so I can pick it first. I think, you know, I was thinking about it. I never wrote a biography before I wrote on Rosa, and she kind of came to me out of the larger project that I spoke about earlier. But I think the one thing I discovered on the other side, I'm still waiting, you know, this is going to be the Zoom in which I throw ideas at Mike and ask him to write them, because he writes so well. The ML Goldman biography that you write, not that other people write who know nothing about anarchism, but you write your own, you know, as an activist, as a writer. I think the one thing I can say, the book has been out now for a year and a half or so, that I've discovered again. I discovered it in my process, and I've discovered it engaging with people who've read the book generously, is that people are still attracted to a life story, to a person that you can sort of move along and think with and see how their personal life relates to whatever they come up with. And obviously, Emma and Rosa both were extraordinary and did so much, so they kind of yield themselves very easily to these kind of studies, but also are very hard subjects in that way. So I think, when you talk, especially to, this is more trade readers rather than academic books where we're supposed to read things, whether we find them deeply engaging and compelling from the beginning or not. But especially if you want to read a book that is fun and interesting and you find it speaks to you as a person, people still want to think about a person like them that has managed to change the world. And again, I go back to this kind of very hard time in which we're living, where especially I think of our students and young people who are coming to age in a really kind of austere and economically and ideologically and everything else environment. If you pick up a book about someone who lived in really hard circumstances of their own, and you can see how they managed to, I don't want to say triumph, because it's never that simple, but yes, to overcome some difficulties or to create their own narrative in whatever way, I think that is a very important thing, again, especially in our time. So I think that's one thing that I found in writing, and again, in reception, people said, oh, I loved it when she did X or Y. You still want a person who is like you. In both these cases, also, it's really important to talk about women in really unequal times who managed to do things that, you know, liberal feminism is still kind of struggling to position as a possibility. So I don't know, I found I've become even more anti-liberal feminism, if possible, after writing Rosa, because she just did everything twice and better than all the men of her time and didn't make a fuss out of it. So that was that. In terms of drawbacks, I don't know, Mike, if you want me to shut up and take the drawbacks, but I can sort of give a few points of that. I think, you know, the advantages are the drawbacks, that you always have to focus on one person. And, you know, at some points I found that I wanted to write quite a bit. She had a group of close women friends who hardly have been discussed in recent historiography. A lot of them died in the camps, got, you know, because she was murdered, she didn't make it to the Holocaust, but they were mostly Jewish and they mostly murdered in the camps. There were chapters where I kind of went AWOL and wanted to research them because not much is known about them, and they were all really interesting and did their own fascinating work. But then I was reminded that it's a book about Rosa Luxemburg and I can't have like the 15-page narrative of her best friend that you never heard about kind of thing. Obviously, we always have to make then hard choices. Who makes it in, who makes it out? And again, like, you lose a lot in that sense. Also in terms of the ideological depth, obviously, if I were to write a book about the concept of freedom in the writings of Rosa Luxemburg, it would be a very different kind of book to the one that I wrote in the end. So I think, you know, as everything, you have the wins, you have the lose. But I have to say, I do have much more respect for biographers after writing the book, because you do really have to understand what an arc of a life is. And you never know that because you've not died. You know, it's like the simple act of writing something that you have never completed yourself, let alone a lot of other things that you can never kind of grasp in full. But really to have that narrative is very, very hard.
Yeah, just to come in on that, I think I agree with everything Diana said. I think I'm not a biographer, although there are many biographies in this book. And I think one of the things that I'm always conscious of is, yeah, we are historians. I'm not afraid of narrative. You know, we are writing stories at the same time with all the kind of politics of that, which we understand as professionals in this area. But, you know, I don't have a problem with that. And I think the issue with trying to get people to grasp the nature of that moment, that particularly in the first part of the book, but also later in the book as well, when you're thinking about a more contemporary moment. You know, I kind of structured the book around two moments, which is something that I nicked from Andrei Grubacic. He gets credit for it. But you know, this idea, there's a first anarchist moment and a second anarchist moment. When I was talking about the late 19th century, yet a lot of the big names come up, you know, Kropotkin, Bakunin, Proudhon. Then you go into the 20th century, you know, Malatesta, all these sorts of people, and centrally Emma Goldman, which obviously is, as Dana says, where we met, really. But what I try to do with the stories is I try not to reproduce the anarchist canon unproblematically, as, you know, many have criticized. But what I try to do is show not that they're exceptional people, but to show how in many ways they were unexceptional. You know, in terms of, yeah, you know, for Emma Goldman, there was also Charlotte Wilson, you know, who is someone who I start the book with, who we as anarchists know, and who Nicholas Walter did, you know, did some stuff to recover, but mostly Susan Hindley, you know, with her studies of Charlotte Wilson, recovered as this kind of campaigning Victorian feminist anarchist who worked across different groups, was in the Social Democratic Federation, was in the Fabian Society, involved in all sorts of activism, and was an ardent propagandist for anarchism in the 1880s, is also unexceptional in many ways. She, you know, when I say she's unexceptional, I don't mean that she's not remarkable. What I mean is that she reflects the experience of a lot of women anarchists of that period who are trying to campaign for these things, whose names are lost to history to some degree. So what I'm trying to do is, going back to what Dana's talking about, how she explored the life of Rosa and the interest that that has for people, is I'm trying to make tangible something to people. I'm trying to make them, you know, be able to grasp and relate to something and see it as real. And, you know, to quote that tired D.P. Thompson quote, which is nonetheless a great quote, you know, to rescue the past from the condescension of posterity, right? You're trying to show people, these people are not idiots, right? These people are not fools because they think differently from you. They are not idiots. They are rational people in their own circumstances who come up with these solutions and believe, in Wilson's case, and I focus a bit on Wilson because of how explicit she is about this, the revolution is possible, and not merely possible, but likely to happen in the near future. And this goes back to something Danny actually said on one of your pods a little while back. You know, another world was possible, you know, the phrase I think that he used. You know, in this period, they really believe that. And, you know, I am an activist, you know, I am a situated author. So when you're writing in the second anarchist moment, which I think we're in, Andrei Grubacic thinks we're in to some degree, then you want to try and be able to outline subjectivities where They don't fit the dominant narrative. They don't fit the framework, but they were more common than people now realize. So you want to other the past by showing that it is different, but at the same time as making it familiar through showing that people are people and they have ideas and that they those ideas are their own and they can put them forwards in different spaces. So I think humanizing stories is great. And actually, just on the an issue we may touch on yet, you know, decolonization, for instance, a big part of the decolonization project for anarchism has been bringing those stories in of the marginalized from the story and showing how they were able to remake anarchism, the debt anarchism owes to spaces beyond Europe and so on that have been unacknowledged and so on. And that's done a lot through human stories. Benedict Anderson's book, Under Three Flags, as it was known, then The Age of Globalization, when it was reissued, where he talks about the anti-colonial imagination, that's often stories of individuals in anti-colonial struggle. So yeah, no, I'm absolutely aware of the problems. And I think for anarchism, there are specific problems because of this fear of hero worship and this fear of creating a canon. But at the same time, I think that means we need to change how we think about individual stories and how we use them and how we recover them and how we celebrate them, rather than, you know, basically we need to get beyond the tiled old same olds and we need to broaden it out in a big way. And as Richard just said, yeah, we do need to engage in storytelling, but we need to be aware of what we're doing when we do that.
And that's really interesting. It kind of leads on to another thing that we wanted to ask you both to address, which is to do with Eurocentrism. And as Mike's just said, you know, the recent scholarship on anarchism historically has been massively enriched by a rejection of or a challenge to Eurocentrism in the sense of methodology, right? So trying to look beyond traditional scholarly spaces for where we recover these stories and interpretations from. And this probably relates as well to like the recovery of, you know, the figures of women anarchists and historical actors, is that without in any way trying to like suggest that it's not a good idea to recover these stories and it's not a good idea to like to challenge ourselves in this sense as researchers, but it does potentially, I think, raise the problem of a history that kind of tries to compensate for what were real failings in these historical movements, to try and sort of say, okay, well, look, you know, there were these amazing women, there were these like non-European decolonial actors involved in this, in the movement. And we present thereby a kind of like whitewashed history of, you know, what in many respects, or in some respects at least, was a movement shaped by patriarchal Eurocentric society and its assumptions. So particularly from the vantage point of somebody who's trying to write like a kind of global introductory history of anarchism, I would be really interested in like how you kind of approach that problem. And I think it would be interesting as well to think about like Rosa Luxemburg as a figure in that sort of, in relation to that problem as well.
I think just in terms of the in terms of the book, you know, it was something that I really grappled with a lot, because, you know, as an activist myself, obviously I'm committed to decolonization. You know, I want to bring voices in that have not been there before and that have been obscured, you know, by structures in the past. And I know exactly what you're saying, Danny, and I know where you're coming from with it. You've got to be careful that it doesn't become a partisan kind of political exercise. Say, well, actually, my movement's all right. You know, we weren't patriarchal, horrible people in the past. Anarchism was actually good because there were all these women anarchists doing this really interesting stuff and the movement was fine. So I think your motivations are really important to what are you trying to do? Like, are you trying to do this? Are you trying to recover these lives for the right reasons in terms of how do you then betray them? You betray them for themselves, right? You betray them because their lives are intrinsically valuable and should be recovered and should not be silenced. That's why they should be there. But I think the issue around, there's a couple of things that come out from that. I mean, I think in the process of recovery of stories, you know, you can still show that the movement is not innocent, you know, or in fact, that can be even more critical. So, for example, I know that yourself and Jim discussed Martha Ackelsberg's book on the Free Women of Spain, the Mujeres Libres, and a few months ago in the pod, talking about the very fact that the very existence of the organization was a reflection on the fact that Spanish anarchism was manichist. You know, and the structures that were supposed to be egalitarian and open and offering rights and opportunities for everybody were not doing that. In recovering that story, Martha Ackelsberg shows us both the agency of women, but also the patriarchy that they were fighting against. So I think you can do both things at the same time. I'm not, you know, so, and in a way, what I tried to do with some of the women's lives that I brought through particularly. And I started with Wilson deliberately in the book because, you know, it's not my original discovery. It's Susan Hinley's work, it's Nicholas Walter's work, you know, Charlotte Wilson's life story. But I wanted to put her front and center because she's an unfamiliar anarchist to most people. People know Emma, but they don't know Charlotte Wilson. So I wanted to start there. But then on the issues around decolonization and globalization and thinking about previous globalizations, and, you know, people like yourselves, Constance, who's on the call, you know, much more expert than me in thinking about some of these international dynamics. One thing that I was really conscious of was needing to tell a global story about anarchism, but it not being a tired story in terms of, oh, now we can cite all these movements as anarchists, because that then makes us the true global, you know, again, being partisan about it. And so one of the things that I say in the book, which might, I don't know if it's controversial, but if read the wrong way, could be seen as critical of some attempts to decolonize. It's not critical of attempts to decolonize, but it's trying to nuance them a little bit. Is I do think that there is a danger that if you simply go to particular places around the world and say this is an anarchist movement, when it has no direct connection to a self-avowed historically anarchist movement and predeceases that movement, in fact. But what you're actually doing is using a Western lens to appropriate something that has its own merits, is its own thing, and it becomes its own form of appropriation, which is really dangerous. And to give an example of what I'm talking about, this wasn't the aim of the scholar in question. I don't want to diss Pat Crone at all, but, you know, Patricia Crone famously wrote an article 20 years ago on 9th century Muslim anarchists, and, you know, not somebody trying to advocate the anarchist movement, not somebody trying to bring a story in for the anarchist movement, but she talks about the Mu'tazilite school of Islamic theology, if you like, as, you know, potentially anarchistic. And that language was totally alien to the Mu'tazilites. You know, one of the weird things that I have as a historian is I also have a degree in theology and I did Islam as an undergraduate. And when I first read that article as an historian and thought, you're calling Mu'tazilites anarchists, you know, I started to be really uncomfortable with how that vocabulary was being used, because that's not what Mu'tazilites would have thought of. And that vocabulary didn't exist then in that way. And you're using a language, really, it's constructed around European nation state forms in the post-Enlightenment period, to talk about something in the, you know, the 9th century, which is, you know, is, it has its own merits and its own discourse and its own debates that need to be engaged with. I think more recently, some of the early attempts to decolonize, maybe about 20 years ago, by people who were in the movement, were well-meaning, but then became too broad brush. You get people saying that Gandhi is an anarchist, bringing Gandhi in. And, you know, you can see that, yeah, there are correspondences, there are connections. Ole's on the call, I think, and Ole's done a huge amount of work in showing connections and networks, and that's meaningful and real. And you want to show how anarchism is changed, remade, altered, reformulated, steals ideas from other cultures and other movements beyond Europe. Shokunishi's done great work on how indebted a lot of the Russian thought that went into early anarchist ideas is to Japanese thought, actually, and Japanese practice. But you don't at the same time want to point at big name historical figures and say that's an anarchist, because that makes anarchism look better. So yeah, I think there are problems, but I think if you're attentive to it, you can nuance that and work around it. The big issues for me, though, just as an author, is a cis white male writing in Europe. And, you know, again, we have that problem, so that is a problem in itself. And I think where the book maybe fails to deliver on some of its promise, to be honest, is in the global sections. The case studies that I do use are India, are Japan, in terms of global spaces. Why? Because the literature is more extensive in some ways on those areas. So I fall back on the literature. And actually, you know, credit to the people who are on the call, and they're cited in the book, and they're credited in the book. But, you know, Constance Bantman, who's on the call, you know, has done amazing work on the, you know, the transnational networks around Europe and so on and beyond in terms of French anarchism. Ole's on the call, done incredible work on India and connections, Indian nationalist movements, separate, you know, independence movements with other movements around the world. You know, I'm standing on the shoulders there, but I haven't brought much that's original of my own in terms of that, which again goes back to being an English-speaking cis white male in England. So there are drawbacks there. It's not as inclusive as it should be or could be. And that global history is still there to be written. So I wouldn't say for a minute like this is even close to a footnote to the last word, you know, but it's trying to be more global in its perspective.
Yes, I'm going to take the question from a slightly different direction, because I hope you forgive me sort of taking it to a different reading, but I kind of, my day job is working in decolonization. I'm an Israeli anti-occupation activist, and what I do in my day job is count settlements and campaign to evict them. So, you know, this is decolonization in the field. And it's been, I've come back to Israel after 13 years in the UK, and it's been really interesting because I've been thinking about all these debates, and I've been having them with comrades here, And working in politics rather than academia means that, you know, the decisions you make will change the policies you partake as a movement and what you will bring to government or to diplomat, which is also part of my job. And I think you put it really well, Mike, but I'm going to take you to a different direction. A lot of the debate around Eurocentrism is trapped in a very neoliberal, tokenistic, individualistic kind of headcount of, I have two white people. Wait, I need two people who are not white, and then I'll be an anti-racist decolonialist. Like, I put it in a really crude way, but honestly, some things you read are kind of like that. And I think the question is of changing our point of view rather than putting in and out a different person. And I think, you know, Mike, you covered the kind of methodological part better than I ever could. But the question is, if we are talking about decolonization in theory, which is something I've been thinking about also in my written work, it means really to take a different point of view and also to put your own point of view and to say, you know, maybe if I want someone to write a history of anarchism in a region, I don't know, I shouldn't be the person to do that. And, you know, it's interesting because a lot of these ideas are now trickling into here, and especially from America, where they're both getting pushed back, but also embraced in an interesting way. And the thinking that you need to diversify certain ideas, and you need to, I'm saying diversify, although obviously you asked about decolonization, but very often these get muddled. You know, that's kind of my overarching point. I don't think we're nearly close to a point where European academia actually wants to decolonize itself. I don't think we're even in the 10, 15, 20 years. We're at a point where there's pushback, which is really good, where people are asking difficult questions, which is really good, and where different voices are beginning to be heard, which is really, really very important. But we're not nearly close to a point where you don't have to take roles in Marx's core modules. And then if you want, you can take African political theory, because we're really into decolonization in this department, yeah? And I mean, in a way, I've become more forgiving since coming here, because I think, you know, it takes time. There are a lot of other challenges. It's all happening at the same time. The pushback is really very significant. You know, you can't underestimate what the Black Lives Matter protests did, what Rose Must Fall did in the UK. I was in the original Rose Must Fall protests, and, you know, the questions that students came from with asked questions that basically moved a lot of the movement along. But I think to think that we're jumping from there to what a decolonized curriculum might nearly look like is a really big stretch. And I mean, and just end on you asked about Rosa, who's really complicated in that, but I will talk about someone else who I think is actually more relevant. So there's a really interesting Israeli-Egyptian feminist called Jacqueline Kahanov, who, you know, in trying to bridge the divide, because beyond the occupation, which is the thing I work on and troubles me most in the world, there's also racism within Israeli society that is not unlike what we're seeing in European cultures and American campuses, et cetera, towards Jews from Arab origin. And she writes a lot about the Levantine identity and how it might look like if we accept that we are in the Levant and this is where we're at, which again, we're not even close here. You know, if I'm saying that Britain is not even close, we're like 20,000 steps behind and not even thinking about the right questions yet. But I think only when we get to these kind of questions and really sort of think deeply about repositioning the entire system and the entire structure, then we can actually look at decolonization in a serious manner. And, you know, maybe apart from anarchism, decolonization is another concept that has been thrown around without really understanding the depth of what it might mean. So, you know, there's maybe an interesting ideological parallel there. But yeah, I think, you know, it's an interesting moment. Definitely the way forward is to accept these questions, to accept these critical debates, to understand that we can't still do everything the way that we want to right now. You don't move from 0 to 100. And decolonize in the world. I think that's the thing that now strikes me. I think back on a lot of the academic debates and how people stop talking to each other and kind of take sides in intellectual debates. Imperialism and colonialism are alive and well. So before we start decolonizing our mind, maybe decolonize the world first, which is what we're trying to do humbly here.
I find that really interesting. All those points really interesting. And it reminded me of one of the last departmental meetings I was a part of in my previous job, where we were brainstorming as a department how we could decolonize a curriculum. And, you know, a room of white European academics, you know, trying to do that. And, you know, some ideas were really good. Some were, I thought they were appalling. And, you know, one of the points you made, Dan, it rang true with me when I thought, maybe it's not really possible to decolonize this history department and for it to continue in anything like the way that it thinks. It's not a case of adding another module. You're right. It's a good idea to start having these conversations, but boy, we're a long way from it. And I didn't even pretend to know what I think it would look like, but I just kind of felt it wouldn't look like that. But anyway, moving on. Yeah, so we've kind of touched on this a little bit as well, thinking when we started about thinking about the contemporary relevance of anarchism. And, you know, to me as someone, it was made not a secret by the publisher, actually, that I was one of the readers of Mike's manuscript. The publishers then just told everyone that was me. So the blind review process wasn't really that feasible. Anyway, some of my comments, you know, a lot of it, the most interesting parts, Mike, were, you know, where you were discussing the so-called new anarchists, to use David Graeber's phrase, and, you know, particularly post-Second World War onwards, but really actually kind of mid-90s, early 2000s stuff, which was all quite new to me as someone that usually kind of lives in that early 20th century world. What do you think about about that term, the new anarchists, about, you know, these ideas that, you know, anarchism is perhaps winning because everyone's really kind of acting anarchist now, you know, like what link, if any, this has to the more classical period, you know, as someone that's just written a book that spans, you know, across these two moments, can you kind of elaborate on that and what you see as the, you know, the relevance of the classical to the new anarchist?
Thanks for that, Jim. Yeah, sorry they blew you up, but they did. And but yeah, I mean, I think the contemporary stuff, or the more contemporary stuff, the post-war stuff, is going to be the stuff that excites the most grief in terms of, because, you know, some of the things, you know, I take positions on things that people are still alive now and, you know, and won't be happy about, but like, I think there is, I mean, first things first, like, I don't think that they're totally sundered from each other. So that's the first thing. So we might come to that in a bit. But I don't think these two things are totally cut off from each other in the way that some people have argued in the past. But what I do think is that, you know, the period is, so David Graeber, anyone who's on the call who doesn't know this, probably all know David Graeber, you know, famous anarchist anthropologist, sadly passed away last year. Big figure in the Occupy movement. Big figure, to be honest, on certain wings, well, the left of the Labour Party, actually, until quite recently, well, until his demise. He was close to some of the people around Navarra Media. He was. I think people may be aware, he actually canvassed for Rebecca Long Bailey as Labour leader. So you know, he took a very anarcho-Corbyn, I think Ruth has called it, anarcho-Corbyn approach to politics towards the end. But Graeber wrote this piece in 2002 for New Leftery, which I know you talked about again on the podcast, The New Anarchists, which is a piece which I talk about in the book, which is an essay arguing, as you've said, Jim, that whether or not it's conscious of itself as anarchism or not, the modern political scene amongst a certain section of the global left is anarchist by nature. He actually uses the word imminent at one point, immanent, you know, that it's present in everything they do. It's non-hierarchical. And obviously Occupy came later, but he was seen as, you know, a kind of theoretician of Occupy, if you like. And, you know, he draws a line in some of the stuff that he writes, like the Democracy Project and so on, between the, you know, the anti-globalization movement, the ultra-globalization movement in the 90s, these new anarchists that have emerged who are committed to direct action, anti-parliamentary activism or extra-parliamentary activism, and then Occupy that comes later, and so on and so on and so on. And there's a straight line that's drawn between all of this. And obviously, as you've talked about on the pod, there then was an institutional turn, and then there was an Corbynism, Sanders movement, and so on, and all the rest of it. And I think looking at that, it's quite interesting to me, I think, that, you know, there were some, and there have been some of more of us self-consciously in the modern new anarchists, you know, self-identified anarchists of this period, particularly in North America, who have distinguished very sharply between this movement and the classical anarchist movement, if you like, and said, well, we don't have anything to learn from them. We're new and we are doing all these things and blah, blah, blah. I think that's receding a little bit now. I think there's, what you have now is not an either or between a modern anarchism, which is totally cut off from the past, or a reenactment society for the CNT in the 30s. You know, there is an attempt now, I think you're seeing amongst younger people who identify as anarchists, to identify with the historic movement, Bread Tube, Zoe Baker's work on YouTube and so on, trying to promote, you know, connections and see correspondences. But I think it's just a reflection of the fact that modern anarchism definitely owes a lot to the historic anarchist movement. It absolutely does. But what the book tries to chart is how anarchist ideas and practices survived in other movements and corresponded with, even if they weren't responsible for or directly, so, you know, directly impactful on, practices that are happening in other movements like, you know, second wave feminism and so on, and the, and like black anarchism as it evolves, or originally black power and then black anarchism comes out of that. And what the modern anarchisms that you see now are a confluence of lots of those different elements. And some of them, again, like in the past, are more or less conscious of themselves as anarchisms. Some of them are more or less critical of anarchism, but drawing some anarchist ideas. There's a plurality, again, as there was actually in the first anarchist movement. So it's not trying to be an artificial comparison, but there is a you know, kind of, God, I don't want to use the word synergy in a meeting like this, but there is a kind of resemblance, if you like, between those two moments. I think there is a more conscious attempt now to recover the anarchist past by the generation beyond the new anarchists. But I also think there's a fracture. So I also think the institutional turn has in some ways kind of, and it just goes back to something I was listening to you guys talk about the other night on the first anniversary review you did while I was going running on Danny's pieces for the newsletter. There's almost been a kind of mea culpa, I think, by some who got involved in anarcho-Corbynism and so on, that, like, actually, you know, yeah, really, party politics really doesn't work, you know, and some people have taken that and started reading Conquest of Bread and doing all that stuff. And then there's other people who are saying, well, it was only ever a tactical intervention. My politics have been consistent. It was just something that I did for a while. And now we'll go back to doing this. So, long story short, as ever, I think there is a connection between the two, and I think there is a project within and without academia to recover that memory, and, you know, which is useful for activists now, but it doesn't delimit the horizons of what the future anarchisms might be. And in fact, it's only going to be one small part of that. It's vocabulary and resource, but it's not, you know, again, it's not to be a CNT reenactment society from the 1930s. It's about providing ideas for the future that can be remade in new contexts.
I'd like to go to the CNT Reenactment Society, just for the record. I think it sounds great. Sorry, Danis, I'll go back to you.
Yeah, I don't have a whole bunch to add to that. There was already a great question in the chat that kind of relates to what I was going to say, which is, this is about anarcho-Corbynism. And it's interesting to see, obviously, you know, great. I used to teach the New Anarchist just because I love it so much, and a good way to get students to think about what anarchism might mean for them today. It goes back to the point I made earlier, that I think we're underestimating just how hard things might be for younger people who are drawing into these movements, and how little by way of flourishing and possibility and imagination is offered through the infrastructure, especially after, so this is a very British discussion, in Britain, after a lot of Tory rule years in a row, that came after New Labour, which wasn't a huge, you know, breath of inspiration for anyone. I think I could say that in this party, at least. So I think there is a dynamic there that is repeating itself, and certainly beyond the dynamics and ideological discussions that I will leave to Mike, we can see how the pushback comes from a specific place, which is a huge ideological kind of squashing, really, of creativity, of imagination, really kind of bringing down life to its bare minimum for many people, and especially, of course, always the working class minorities. And I think, again, this is, it's a historical cycle, right? Like, that's where anarchism comes from in its origins, and that's where anarchism finds its revival again. And there's a reason why a lot of young people came to Occupy and came and followed Graeber, because they needed that. It's not because they wanted to be anarchists or because they understood what anarchism means, but because they needed something beyond what their lives offered to them. So I think, you know, we need to really take a close look at the kind of possibilities that are around us right now, and become aware of, so I'll do it in a positive, maybe dialectical way, what nourishing, inspirational, motivating, galvanizing ideas and practices anarchism can bring to today's world. Because really, and I have to say, even in, you know, I'm sorry to say that, but even within a lot of socialist contemporary writing, there's a lot of poverty of ideas, of imagination, of just the ability to think beyond, you know, what, I'm not even saying another world is possible, but just to go beyond just miniature critiques and infighting and ideological disagreements. So I think, again, it kind of makes perfect sense that there will be a revival that comes out of historical, ideological, political context. And yeah, and I think it's interesting, especially with Graeber, I have to say, he does bring so many people who would otherwise, if you would say anarchism, would you like to engage, they'll be like, no, no, no. But when they read him, he really speaks to something very deep within the contemporary experience and sort of gives people a way out of understanding themselves in a very narrow framework. I think that's one of the great things of his writing. Anarcho-Corbynism, I'll let Mike take that, but I just want to say that Corbynism itself hasn't been completely understood. You know, the Owl of Minerva is still in the tabloid press today. I saw a story of Corbyn being a Czech spy or something like that. So, you know, people are still kind of obsessed with anecdotes and not really sort of, I think we don't still know the arc of everything that happened over the last 5-6 years or so, if you kind of campaign and which had got us. But certainly there was an anarchist turn within it, and that is probably one of the better things that happened from that period.
If we can just come back and be uncharacteristically brief, just the point that Dana made then about poverty of imagination on the left, I think something that I bang on a lot about on Twitter is COVID, obviously. And you know, one of the things that, you know, what Dana's saying about the issues about how little opportunities people have had to frame politics differently, you know, really resonates with me, because when you look at COVID, actually, you know, when you look back to the historical stuff, you know, you really do see Malthus, and you really do see Kropotkin fighting Malthus and what was at stake in that debate, you know, and the Kropotkin understood what was at stake in that debate. But even Proudhon understood it. I mean, Proudhon said, you know, what was it Proudhon said about Malthus's ideas? This is murder for the love of God. You know, this is murder in the cause of righteousness, murder for the love of God. You know, the idea that people are expendable, which obviously then evolves through social Darwinism, but ideas that are consistently associated with the right. And when you see discourses today about the clinically vulnerable, the clinically extremely vulnerable, hands up on the clinically vulnerable side, you know, you see these eugenicist frames that have always been there in right politics, you know, in pro-capitalist politics. You see these frames articulated again and again. And as you say, like, you know, you see the people's responses to them. People, you know, even people who are trying, struggle to grapple with just the magnitude of how deeply embedded some of these ideas are into culture and how little opportunities there have been to imagine politics differently. So I think that's absolutely right. But I think that really is the gauntlet thrown down to us, actually, in terms of the next stage beyond where we are, is to fight a war at the level of the imagination. You know, that, I mean, and I know in a way that's a bit pat, because that's kind of what the situation has tried to do. And that's kind of, but I think that is really where the stakes are, because actually, if you go back to the 1880s, you know, there was a reason, or the 1890s even, there's a reason why Kropotkin gets commissioned to write articles of the 19th century, because they took him seriously, right? We need to get our political imaginary taken seriously by as large a group of people as any. But that's where I am positive, because that's where I'm not dismissive, you know, of things like BreadTube or the YouTubers or so on. Yes, some of that space is bad, but at the same time, it's also a bit Freirean in the sense that people are being met where they are, and being met with ideas that are unfamiliar to them. And that's, you know, a resource of hope, really. So
Jim and I are going to shut up and open the floor. We have one question that's come in on the Q&A. Please type in any others that you may have. So I'll just read it out. From Sol Gamsu, thank you very much for your question. Do you think there's a distinction between anarcho-Corbynism and the libertarian left within Corbynism? Thinking of a meeting on Big Flame at The World Transformed 2018, we might be getting into the micro nuances of the contemporary British left. We might be. So feel free to leave this question. No, it's too late now. Also, some on the libertarian left actually turned out to be half-baked social democrats, CF Navarra. Okay, does anyone want to come back on that?
I mean, it kind of goes back. That's a really great question. I love it. I think I need to think about it a bit more, which is a way to apologize for my answer. I think there is a lot of confusion. I kind of like the cheap shot I've written for them. So I kind of enjoy that the half-baked social democrats, Novara, who think of themselves as like Leninists and communists. And, you know, they commissioned some work from Jon Rose and they were like, yeah, but we're Leninists. And I was like, fine, okay. Still don't think we understand Corbynism deeply enough. Certainly it gave rise to a new wave of anarchism. I think that is out there. I don't know enough to talk about the divisions between anarcho-Corbynism and the libertarian left, but I will say that it kind of goes back to my previous point that the pushback has been just so hard against very restrictive policies within the Labour Party itself. I mean, if you think about the Labour Party before Corbyn, it was kind of like policies, ideas, sort of that were very kind of small improvement on Tory Lib Dem, etc. And then came this man, love or hate him, just gave a whole different framework and brought with him people who could think differently. And I mean, I don't think that the libertarian left and or anarcho Corbynism had enough leeway or traction within what happened. I think what happened in the end, sadly, is that the party mechanism and even within that strand of left, the kind of more organizational strand took control, and that became Corbynism more centrally, which is interesting in itself. You know, it might be that my estimation is wrong, but I kind of feel that it never kind of took hold enough in the way that it would be interesting to see what happened. They would have more control of the discourse and ideational change. But I think, you know, I'm going to say something very uneducated and non-academic. For me, it was just really lovely to see people who flocked and tried to find a new interpretation of freedom within the left, whatever cleavage you want to put them in. Because again, those people are now not around, and they weren't before. And it'd be interesting to see if the British political landscape can create a similar movement within the next few years. And I think there's something, again, as someone who has recently left, there's something very restrictive and depressing and kind of demoralizing about the way that the British left usually conducts itself. And just this pushback in its own right was something that I think is really important and have opened the door for more anarcho whatever in the future, not Corbynism, whatever the next movement will be. So yes, I'm going to stop there because I think it's much more of Mike's field, but appreciate the question.
Dana's absolutely spot on in terms of understanding what Corbynism was. Is a really, I mean, you know, we all have ideas on it, and but in terms of what it actually amounted to, it's difficult, you know, to fully grasp what it was all about or what was going on or how many different things intersected. I think going back to Saul's question, I think the answer is, yeah, I would distinguish between anarcho-Corbynism and the libertarian left, insofar as I think myself and Saul are representative of, you know, of aspects of it in terms of, there are a lot of anarchists, for instance, who voted for Labour in 2019, me included, by the way, sorry. You know, in the sense that, you know, the alternative seems really, really awful. And guess what it was? So that's not an argument for organising with electoral politics, but it was an argument of, you know, this could differentially make some sort of a difference as a tactical, you know, choose your enemy sort of decision, which is a common issue in anarchist abstentionism or debates over it. But I think when Ruth talks about anarcho-Corbynism, and I know she's quite critical in some of the stuff that she's written about Ruth Kinner, for those who don't know, first name is Ruth all the time. You know, when she talked about it, I think one of the things where she was a bit skeptical in some of the things she's written is the extent to which actually the poverty of the political imagination on the British in Britain has been so bad for so long. I don't want to put words in her mouth, but like, you know, going on what she's written about it, that, you know, it seemed like it was the only show in town. It seemed to a lot of people. You know, so a lot of people got involved in it because they thought, well, you know, this is something where we can actually affect change, the dam might burst, etc. And going back to what Dana said, absolutely right. You know, the party machine won, ultimately, along with, you know, every other force allied to that. And the net result of that then is, where does that energy go? Is that energy harnessable? Is that an anarchist turn in itself? You know, are people accelerated into anarchism? Because they realise that all bureaucracies are ultimately impossible to compromise with, you know, that they will always lead to these sorts of ends. You know, where do we go next? How do we get that energy? How does it move forwards? I think that's the key question. And I know that, you know, Danny and Jim have reflected on that. I remember Jim telling a story on the pod about somebody that he knew, respected, had been active in Labour, who just felt locked out from Labour, you know, because of what had happened. And I think the key thing about it is, like, I'm not shamefaced. I've made many political decisions that were bad decisions, and I have made many errors, and the key thing is just to learn all the time, but also not to be too judgmental, because you could be wrong yourself. You know, it's just a question about having big conversations about, you know, how do we move forward as a left. I do think, not that I think this is anything remarkable to say, the Labour Party is obviously dead now for a lot of people as a vehicle for any kind of thing, and I don't think people are going to bother with it for much longer. So just on the World Transform specifically, I'd be interested to see if that unmoors itself from the Labour Party, or it keeps having events at Labour Party conferences, because I have to say, I don't really see the point of that. I think there's a lot of interesting things that are being thought about in that context, but I don't really see the point of going down to Brighton, if you get my point.
Thanks, both. Yeah, some really interesting thoughts to take away there. And as Mike said, it does feed into the discussion that me and Danny had about kind of the experience of the last five years, coming at it from our own perspectives, and, you know, our own particular interactions with the Labour Party, both kind of nationally and in our local area, which I think are quite different as well. With both being in Liverpool, it's a different show in town, I guess, sometimes. Danny knows I'm talking about this because basically today I had a bit of a falling out with some local Labour councillors. So, you know, if I've got that fresh in the memory, and they didn't feel like an Arco Corbyn. They felt very much like quite tedious Labour, classic Liverpool Labour people. This conversation is continuing in the chat, but I guess it's staying on that same theme or question. Does anyone want to get a question in, you know, on something else that they'd like to raise, or do Dana or Mike have anything they'd like to say to one another, that kind of thing, just to keep things ticking?
I mean, just to go to the point of what's happening right now in British political landscape, but also, you know, in my proximity and sort of thinking about the world transform and what it might be doing now. I think, you know, clearly you kind of said very cuttingly that the Labour Party is for a while not going, I mean, you were harsher than I was, but it's not going to be the source of hope, rejuvenation for a while. But I think it was interesting. I didn't go to Brighton, I was stuck here. But just thinking of the idea that there's a festival of discussions and intellectual debates, and not just micropolitics. So I went to the World Transformed when it was kind of Corbynism, and it was very exciting because we thought, you know, next election we'll get in and then all these great ideas will become policies. But I think actually there's something, you know, in a way that's the second international, right? You had a group of people who knew very well they're not going to go into power anytime soon, but they spent a lot of time thinking very seriously about ideas. And, you know, there are enough people who I really appreciate who took the time to go to the World Transformed. So I think actually, the fact that we're going away from these kind of parties and divides and spending some time on ideas and on policies and on what a different future might look like, you know, that is really essential. And that is probably going to be a source of any kind of rejuvenation that we will see. And maybe it won't happen through the Labour Party. You know, as an Israeli, I always think maybe there'll be a new party in Britain because that happens here all the time. But maybe I didn't learn in my 13 years of the dynamic of the British political landscape. But I do think, you know, we cannot underestimate just having that space for conversation and for discussion. So credit to actually doing that. But yeah, I mean, there's been a discussion on the chat on trade unions, which we can pick up just briefly, and because I think it's very relevant to a lot of people in their day jobs and all just thinking of prospects of the near few months, really. And you know, I can, with my Rosa Luxemburg biographer hat on, I can say a lot of very mean things about the trade union movement. I don't need to do that. But I think there is a kind of bureaucratization and lack of any kind of ability to really change through the movement, which is deeply hard to think about, because again, that's where we want change to come from. That's where we're investing energy and time. And I know there are quite a few reps on this call. So I kind of think that it's a really very important forum for rejuvenation. But I think it's really important also just to acknowledge the restriction, especially as Mike said, in times of COVID, which he's actually, and at the same time of writing the book, has been doing absolutely stellar work and just showing what COVID means in academia, beyond academia, what it's like living within this setting. This is where we need trade unions the most. And this is where we can't afford to lose them to bureaucratic and emancipatory structures, because we won't survive, quite literally. Like, this is a moment in which we really need them to do their work. So I'll stop there, but I think it's a really important point, so I'm grateful to those who raised it.
I'm wary of the fact that Dana is 2 hours ahead of us. It's creeping up to being quite late. So, you know, we won't go on longer than we need to, but I will give the opportunity for anyone for any last questions or thoughts, and then maybe we'll wrap. Right, I reckon we may have reached a natural point, and a very good one. I'm glad where that conversation took us. Yeah, no, I think we're all getting there. It's Friday. We've all had a nice time. Let's not keep grinding that where we don't need to. So it remains our role to say thank you once again. I thought that was a really, really great conversation. Really, you know, really enjoyed engaging with both of you on this, using Mike's great book as a kind of a way into talking about all of this stuff. So it's brilliant. Go and get a copy. No, absolutely do get a hold of it. I'm sure, you know, you all know how to buy books. So go and buy it from someone sound. And anyone like to say, you know, Tara, the floor is yours.
Just to say thank you. This has been such a joy and really kind of, I think for me it was really necessary to have this conversation, to think back on the book and what it might do for us. So thank you, Mike, for writing it. And thank you, Jim and Danny, for hosting us. And go read Mike's book. I cannot commend it enough.
If I just follow up on that and say, definitely go and read Dana's books, plural, but definitely read Rosa Luxemburg because it's a brilliant biography. And I was reading it while I was writing this one. And, you know, it's a very inspirational text. So I would recommend it to anyone. Somebody else who is very concerned with relating the history to the now in a tangible way. So, yeah, I definitely recommend that. But thanks to Danny. Thanks to Jim for doing this, guys. Really appreciate it. Three Scouse anarchists, we can do this stuff together. But so thanks. I appreciate that. And thanks to everyone who's come. I really appreciate it, particularly given, you know, it's Friday night and, you know, people have been working and things. So thanks to everybody. It means a lot.
Thanks very much, everyone, for coming, for the comments on the chat and everything. And have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening. If you're interested in buying Mike's book, which I can thoroughly recommend, there are some discount codes in the show notes.
As ever, you can keep in touch with the podcast via email, abcwithdunnyandjim@gmail.com, and Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, all at abcdunnyandjim. You can subscribe to our newsletter via the website abcwithdunnyandjim.substack.com. The latest post, Revolution Number Yar Danka by Danny, explores the 1969 Summer of Soul and the Black Woodstock, and is well worth a read. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Dinuccio, Gente de Miña Terra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. And the image in this episode is a screenshot of Mike, Dana, Danny and me having a lovely time on a Friday evening. Love and solidarity. Until next time.